tonight on Arena. Reviews this evening with Jerry Springer, Flights, Camera, Action, American Primeval and Patience on the telly, and new albums from Franz Ferdinand, Ringo Starr and Ethel Kane. #51551 is the text, and you can get us on socials at RTE Arena. And yes, indeed, we are starting with television when I find the opening page to what I have to tell you about all the three pieces that we're talking about tonight. And here it is, not in my hand. So the first one that we're going to talk about is from Netflix, a new series called American Primeval, a gritty western that explores the birth of the American West in the 1850s. The series, created by Mark L. Smith, explores the violent clashes, and that is an understatement when I say violent clashes, between the different cultural and religious groups as they fought to gain control of the New World. Patience is a new detective drama on Channel 4, follows the story of a detective who forms an alliance with a brilliant, self-taught criminologist called Patience, whom she discovers working in the Yorkshire Criminal Records Department. And Jerry Springer, Flights, Camera, Action is a Netflix docuseries that delves into the extraordinary world of one of America's most infamous talk shows, the Jerry Springer Show, of course. It promises to take us behind the scenes to reveal its biggest scandals, both on and off the camera. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser are into the new year with us, and they've watched all three. Delighted to have them with me in studio this evening. Going to start with that American Primeval. It's a new Western series on Netflix, portrays brutal, and that's another understatement, period in the US when people sought a new life on the Western frontier. Betty Gilpin plays a young mother, Sarah Rowell, who makes the journey from Philadelphia to Utah with her son and is overwhelmed by the lawlessness she finds there. No matter what you say about this series, Jen, it's an understatement of just how dark, how gory, how brutal it is.
Yeah, this is the violence of the creation of America in a way. So this is what happens when the writer of The Revenant, Mark L. Smith, decides to tackle the myth of the Western. So basically, this is no Yellowstone. It's no triumphalist fable at all. And nothing about this time of like land grabbing is romanticised at all in this series. So it's bringing us back to the kind of grit and the misery of the frontier times, of maybe something like Deadwood, but it has zero humour. There's no twinkly, you know, sweary Ian McShane here to hold your hand. This is all about degradation, bloodshed, brutality. So if that is your kind of ideal January viewing, then fill your cowboy boots with these six episodes. I mean, it's about religion, it's about land, it's about self-interest. And these themes are still prominent, obviously, in the America of today. So it's this very sprawling story. Now, that's the thing, because there's a lot of threads here of different factions fighting over this land that you have to kind of get to grips with. So, as you said, you have Betty Gilpin, who people would know from Glow, Netflix Glow, and her son. So she's trying to get to Philadelphia to the boy's father in this place, Crook Springs. But it's not what it seems. So you're starting off, she might appear like this damsel in distress. She's very horrified about the violence around her and shocked that her son is exposed to, you know, this kind of masculinity. Mm. But you do see, end up seeing that there is a bounty hunter on her trail who's accusing her of murder and of fraud. So eventually they come to the guidance of this frontiersman, Isaac, who's played by Taylor Kitsch from Friday Night Lights. Yeah. And he's been raised by this Indian tribe, and he has all the wherewithal and all the noose of them. And then you also have Jim Bridger, which is played by Shea Whigham, and he's this mountain man. He's built this place, Fort Bridger, as this outpost to everybody. Yes, you know, all comers welcome.
This is your final, at this point in time, this is the kind of the final frontier before you head off.
Exactly.
Into the Wild West.
This space comes to the attention of the Mormons and the head of the Mormon faith, Brigham Young, who wants this space for himself and his growing religious sect. So they're all the kind of big stories that are coming together.
Groups that are in conflict with each other. And of course, the Native Americans
as well.
Let's have a listen to a clip from, this is the point where they've made their way to your man, what's his name? They've made their way to his town. Now, they will go into this town, the place is full of mud, the people are filthy, dirty, they've, you know, there's very little by way of any kind of ordinary facilities.
There's no order.
Nothing.
And it's chaos.
Absolutely no order. And you know that at any moment, anything can happen. So she's a bit annoyed that her guide has disappeared without her, the person who's supposed to take her on from this point. And she's making that clear in this clip as she speaks to Bridget about, you know, any chance that you might be able to help us find somebody else. But listen to how quickly it turns from just any chance of finding us a guide into something totally else.
We got a problem.
Where's Mr. Beckworth?
He's left. That's your problem.
Walking. He's left.
God damn it, I told you to move them half-dead mules of yours. They're sitting in my walkways again.
It's Jim Bridger. It's his establishment.
Mr. Bridger, we were to meet a Mr. Beckworth here. He's to guide us to Crook Springs.
Oh, non, c'est Henri.
And as I was telling your man, you're late in from St. Louis.
We had some weather problems.
Weather's always a problem. It's going to be a problem for Beckworth if he waited on you any longer. What's this? What are these bushwhackers going to make it up right there?
Perhaps it's possible that we would catch up with
him. You tell them if they want to pick it up.
Tu t'accompagnes?
Not there.
I can guide us
Mr.
there.
Mr. Fry, I have said I appreciate we need someone with experience in this region. Excuse me. Mr. Bridger. We need your help.
Step back, friend. Ami?
Perhaps there are other guides.
There's those that know the way.
Friend.
Bye, Ami.
Take that trip.
So don't tell somebody to step back out of your way is the lesson there. In about, we're about 3-4 minutes into American Primeval.
It's like getting on the Lewis.
Yeah. It's phenomenally violent. And there's more violence after the clip that we just heard, immediately after the clip that we just heard. I was making the foolish mistake as I started on this one, Chris, of jotting down characters' names. I thought, I'll just jot down the characters. And then it stopped.
Oh, forget about it.
There's no point in doing that. Wait until the end of the episode and see who's still standing.
Yeah, you also have to kind of lean into the dialogue a little bit. You know, there's various things happening at once. A lot of characters are kind of speaking over one another. I should say the look of this thing is something else.
It is very cinematic, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Peter Berg, I mean, he is a filmmaker, first and foremost. And we are used to seeing Peter Berg put Mark Wahlberg in all types of terrible situations in Deepwater Horizon, Patriot's Day, Mile 22. But for this, he is directing all 6 episodes. I read an interview with him where he was talking about how he wanted to make as authentic as possible depiction of, you know, the old West. And as Jen was saying, like, this is no romanticized version of the beginning of America. And as a result, he wanted his characters to kind of look as though they've just been dragged through mud, as though they've been raised in hell. And he was talking about how, you know, the actors, Betty Gilpin or Taylor Kitsch, they would come back from makeup and they'd have like dirt strewn across their face, and he would say, send them back, more mud, more dirt. And you can really, I mean, Shea Whigham, who's a wonderful character actor, when he comes into it, you do sit there and think, God, Shea looks so he hasn't had a wash in weeks, you know. So it does look fantastic, and there were parts where I was thinking, this would have made for a great 2.5 hour solid Western on the big screen. It deserves to be seen on the big screen, especially when it comes to, a difficult to watch but genuinely fascinating reconstruction of the Mountain Meadows Massacre of 1857.
This is a real life event.
This is a real. Yeah, so you had 120 pioneers who had settled on this land for a night or two, and Mormons came along and told them that you can't stay on this land. Threats were made, and the next day you had various members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You had the Utah Territorial Militia, and they had also brought along a Native American tribe, and all of these pioneers were slaughtered. And in the story that Peter Berg and Mark L. Smith are telling, all of the people were left for dead, but you had Betty Gilpin's character who gets away with her son, and you also had one Mormon played by Dane DeHaan. His name is Jacob. We think that he's dead. The Mormons also think that he's dead, but he's not. So he actually, the people that he's going to ask for help, to help find his wife, are the same people who tried to kill him. So that adds another layer to the story.
And it did strike me that as we're watching this, of course, if you're watching an historical drama, it's making some kind of comment on contemporary society. And it did strike me that anybody who survived that period was one
rough
of several things.
Tough. Yeah.
They
yes.
were tough, they were rough, they were probably highly intelligent, highly strategic, and incredibly lucky on top of all of that.
I think there is an edge to it. Like, I mean, Chris was saying, I think Shea Whigham, he's such an underrated
he's a great character.
Character.
This is the fella in that frontier town.
Yes, and he's so watchable and he's very cynical, and the tension between him and, you know, trying to hold on to this outpost, this little stake of land that he has, and the religious sect is, for me, the most interesting of the storylines. And like, I think if anyone has watched Under the Banner of Heaven, which was this really underrated drama series with Andrew Garfield that concentrated on the Mormon faith, they would be aware of the birth of Mormonism.
Yes, it talks about this period,
and,
in fact.
And, you know, Brigham Young's ferociousness and his determination about Mormonism. And I think in American Primeval, it has zero sympathy towards any of these characters, really, in that Mormon faith. But also anyone else.
Is there any nuance? It depicts them all as backstabbers. Yeah, well, that's sort of one. Is there any nuance in it?
Scoundrels. And there is that friction in it that makes for a really good drama in that way. And I think it really does have something to say about when you're using religion, you know, to hide more violent tendencies.
What I'm wondering about, you know, how nuanced is any of that? The only thing that the white Americans in the various frontier towns seem to want to know about is how many wives do all of the Mormon men have? And, you know, and it's just so, it's really like, it's puerile, the kind of conversation. Mm-hmm. Like, now, I know we weren't in a very sophisticated society at that point in time. I take that on board. But there's no, it does it get in, I only saw the first episode, does it get in later on into kind of really examining the Mormon faith and how that informed what they believed was their right to be on this land?
A little bit, but if you're looking for nuance, I mean, don't go anywhere near anything that Peter Berg has made, or even Mark L. Smith to a degree.
Well, The Revenant, you know.
I mean, there are sections throughout this with the because it gets to a point too where 10 minutes might pass without a violent sequence, so another one is thrown in or another fight is thrown in, and you do it does get a little bit tedious, and there are scenes in this that are difficult to forget. You know, I found myself like, I'm usually able for this kind of thing, and I found myself backing away from the television at points.
You know, certainly not one you're going to binge on. You're going to watch
one episode. Sometimes how much more can you bear bear in both ways, because I felt like that about The Revenant as well. It really is ultra masculine, ultra violent, and it's oftentimes very punishing. And sometimes I think the roads and the strands of the stories, they all are leading up to a very certain horror and bloodshed, and that's either your bag or it's not. But I do think it could have been streamlined into one more stricter focused story.
Absolutely. Both very well acted. Betty Gilpin is terrific.
Oh, the performances are astonishing.
And the relationship between herself and Taylor Kitsch, that's the storyline that I'm sticking with. That's the reason that I keep watching. He's the gruff mountain man, and also the trail finder who reluctantly agrees to bring her to California.
Stars from you on this one, Chris?
I think three. I think there's a great film in there. And also the running time kind of suggests, I mean, one episode is about an hour long, another is 40 minutes, another is half an hour. It's a little bit strange. Why there's such a difference. So I think you could have had an epic big screen Western. Instead, you've got a baggy series.
Okay. So I'd say three. And what are you saying, Jen?
I'd say three as well. I think, you know, I like that it's a move away from the fables of something like Yellowstone, and it really is showing you something about a land that was never free, that is America. And, you know, with the country's current state of affairs, there is a lot there, but it's not the most subtle or easy watch that you're going to have.
Okay, and you said three as well, did you? Yeah. And available on Netflix is American Primeval. Patience is Channel 4's latest drama. Stars Ella Maisie Purvis as Patience, a young archivist and self-taught criminologist with the Yorkshire Police Force. She is neurodivergent, and the quiet solitude of the job appeals to her. But when Detective B. Metcalf, played by Laura Fraser, discovers her hidden talents for solving crimes, they team up together on cases. If you want a cosy crime series, here's your January gift.
Yeah, a little bit. Although there are some scenes in here that are a bit much too. But it is. It's kind of a knotted detective drama, but with a nice little twist in that we are not following a detective for a lot of it. We're following, as you said, an archivist at the York Police Force Criminal Records Department, or as the crime solvers up top refer to it as Paper Mountain. And they don't like it when the archivists down at Paper Mountain deliver the wrong files. But with Patience Evans, played here by Ella Maisie Purvis. She never delivers the wrong files, but she might assist with the files. So you have Beatrice Metcalf, who is a detective. She is asked by her boss, played by Mark Benton, to just look into a crime that looks like a closed case. A man looks as though he died by suicide. He actually set himself on fire in an empty car park. And it looks as though, look, there's nothing here. We checked the CCTV footage. But the boss says, just look at it one more time. Yeah. So she asks for a file to be sent up, but two files are sent up. And the other file is another person who died by suicide who might not have.
Right. Well, let's have a listen to the point at which I think this is when she goes back down to the archive, and it mightn't be the very first time that she meets the eponymous Patience, played by Ella Maisie Purvis, but I think it's quite early on. So D.I. Metcalf, Laura Fraser, goes down to the archive room of the police station.
Patrons.
You shouldn't be here. It's authorised personnel only.
Don't worry.
No, I know who you are. You're Detective Inspector Beatrice Metcalf.
Beatrice is an awful mouthful. My friends just call me B.
Right, well, I'm not your friend, and you still shouldn't be back here.
I just have a quick question about the Brendan Clark file, the one you brought me by mistake.
I don't make mistakes. There were matching patterns in the data.
You mean the cash that James and Clark both took out before they died?
That and other things, yeah.
Like what? That Clark was also a psychiatrist?
He's a child psychiatrist.
Probably just a coincidence. And Jameson has stopped practicing.
Nope. They both died on the Friday. On the fourth day of the month.
So did Adesh Opera.
There we are. Patience played by Ella Maisie Purvis and D.I. Metcalf played by Laura Fraser in a scene from Patience. Currently running on Channel 4. I was asking as you were listening to that, obviously it picks up on the fact that Patience notices the matching patterns, the day of the week that the two men died, the number four, and all of these things will become significant, we know from the way it's played. How is the neurodivergency of the character handled?
I thought it was quite clunky. Like, I mean, what supposedly is making the show different from other odd couple crime duo series is the fact that Patience is autistic, and the show really is supposed to centre on how Metcalf confronts her own prejudices or misunderstandings through her relationship with Patience. And that could make an interesting show, but I just think it is using neurodivergence as a MacGuffin, like something that is central to the motivation of the characters, but ultimately kind of unimportant. And, you know, they show Patience like solving puzzles, wearing noise cancelling headphones, telling people she doesn't like to be touched. Like, and this is all within the first 20 minutes, I'd say, of the first episode. And it feels like this very old fashioned take on how to introduce a neurodivergent character in this very extreme kind of way. And it's hardly subtle in that characterization. But I do think that Ella Maisie Purvis, she tries very hard not to be like over the top in that depiction, which I think she should be commended for. But outside of that, it's very familiar detective tropes. And, you know, Metcalf is, she's tough, she's overworked, she's divorced, she's struggling to relate to her young son who also might be neurodivergent. And that storyline, her as a character, I think suffers from being quite well worn. Yeah. Like, there's nothing different there. And I do think a lot of the dialogue sounds like it came from like a really lazy episode of Law and Order. Like there is, it could be forgiven for that if that much trumpeted characterization of Patience was better. But I think it falls down on that too.
What about the characterizations and the casting here of both Ella Mae Purvis and Laura Fraser?
Oh, the casting is brilliant. I thought Purvis and Laura Fraser, who's playing Metcalf, I thought they work brilliantly together, and they do have good, nice chemistry. And but it sometimes feels, especially with Patience, Patience sometimes feels like a background character in her own series, which is a little bit strange. It seems as if it's the focus is more on Metcalf's story, because we're learning a little bit about her background. Just to touch on the dialogue there too, there's a sequence in here where actually we get a few where Patience is attending support meetings for people with neurodivergency, and during those scenes it kind of feels like we're just like 5 seconds away from the characters looking at the camera and teaching us all about what it's like to live with autism. And there has to be a smarter, better way to kind of, you know, educate the audience but also entertain them and give them dialogue that, you know, maybe treats them with a bit more, you know, respect and intelligence.
And were these actual workshops?
They are, yeah. I mean, that's commendable for you. Yeah. So you do look at the casting and you look at the fact that Ella Maisie Purvis, who was diagnosed quite late, like at 17 with autism, and this is her first leading role. And I thought her performance was steady and naturalistic, and that's the reason I'll keep watching. And also, again, her rapport with Laura Fraser, there is a great show there. But everything around it it's a little bit clumsy. And also, I should say, the first two episodes, it's sort of after episode two, it's a murder of the week sort of situation.
Yeah. Yes,
but the first
two episodes
focus on the same crime. And unfortunately, when you give 2 hours over to the crime, you actually start to see that the crimes are They're not very interesting at all. Right. They're convoluted.
I think it may be something to do with it is based on a French-Belgian show.
Yeah.
So Astrid and Raphael, I think it's called. And I don't think, like, when you see something like Bad Sisters and you see what Sharon Horgan could do with a previous show, like a show that was previously made, and give all her strengths to that, to something like that, you realise that maybe these writers aren't translating it enough or giving enough originality or giving it a better spin than they could have. It's kind of sticking quite rote.
All right, so that answers my question. You know, now that if they established the neurodivergency in episodes 1 and 2, did they let the series take care of itself after that? But no, the stories aren't strong enough is the problem.
Stars,
from you, Jen?
I would give it, a 2.5 just for the acting.
Yeah, and from you, Chris?
I'll give it a bit fair, maybe give it a bit fairer than I should be, but give it 3 just for the performances. And I would like to see more from Ella Maisie Purvis. Mm. I do think it's a nice turn from her here.
All right, and that is available on Channel 4. I think you can get all episodes, in fact, on the Channel 4 player right now. Mm. Okay, now we have one more to do. We're going to chant Jerry as we come back in a few minutes' time. But let's have a break first of all. All right, so we've dealt with American Primeval on Netflix and Patience on Channel 4, and back to Netflix now for Jerry Springer, Flights, Camera, Action. Fights, Camera, because there were no flights. There were very expensive flights for the guests, but there were lots of fights, lots of camera and lots of action on the Jerry Springer Show, of course. Former politician turned TV host, became a household name in the 1990s with a talk show that reduced the boundaries of daytime television in the US. Reduced, again, is an understatement there. It really was a race to zero. The new docuseries, Jerry Springer, Fights, Camera, Action, explores how Springer and his team devised a controversial format to deliver outrageous guests, shocking revelations and on-stage brawls. Were you a fan of the Jerry Springer Show back in the day, Jen?
I have to admit, full disclaimer, I'm going to pick up a chair now and throw it at Chris. Like, the thing about it was, we had never seen the likes of Jerry Springer ever before, and it was so exciting. I know this sounds terrible now, what we know of, because, you know, Jerry Springer begat something like the horrors that were the Jeremy Kyle Show, which is like, you know, the vilification of working class people. But this was the days before reality TV, and the great and washed were only seen on the news or in some kind of tragic documentary, and we weren't used to Jerry Springer. We had something like Robert Kilroy, Silk used to be on the BBC, and it was so boring and pedestrian, talking about, like, you know, oh, I like Miss World or something really terrible like that. Whereas this was so curious to me, because there is, you know, for Irish people as well, you had these people that were willing to air their dirty laundry on TV with absolutely zero shame. You would see stuff like, you know, wigs flying, wigs being pulled, like teeth being punched out of someone's head. Like, and it was that onslaught. There was this cavalcade of these technical or American talk shows that came along at that time in the 90s. So, I mean, Oprah was more, you know, soft and cerebral. But then he had Sally Jesse Raphael. She had these red glasses. She was kind of tough and no nonsense, tough but fair. Then he had Ricky Lake, and she had this kind of go girl attitude, Jenny Jones. But then Jerry was the king of them all. This was the America I always thought that they wanted to hide. This was like a John Waters film in the reality of a John Waters film.
Let's listen to a clip from very early on, which is one of the few that doesn't have a fight in it. And this is a media commentator of the time from Chicago, Robert Fetter. And when you hear him and you hear Jerry Springer discussing what this new talk show is going to be, you think, oh, Snor-a-rama. Nobody's going to watch that.
At the beginning of 1992, we got a tip as journalists that this new guy was coming to Chicago to launch a talk show.
Well, you've seen them advertised in newspaper inserts and on television sets. No, not television sets.
So there was a press event where this guy was introduced to the media, and that was where he outlined his vision for the show at that time.
I want them to say, after watching the show, that they learned something about life that they didn't know before, and Jerry didn't get in the way of the telling of that story.
But there was a problem. We had no idea who this guy was. We just knew his name was Jerry Springer.
Councilman Springer, what are you doing?
Trying to make a living.
The apparently he was the former mayor of Cincinnati and had also been very successful in television news as a news anchor and as a news commentator.
Good evening, America's spirit is soaring tonight, right along with the space shuttle Discovery.
The company that I did the news for said Jerry was starting a talk show and you're going to host it. And that, I think, was the idea, that I would do news at night.
We're going to see you again tomorrow. Until then, take care of yourself and each other. Good night.
Good night.
And then do the talk show during the day. So it started out serious.
You're thinking, how did it become the success it became? I think it's down to very much, there's one man in question here, Richard Dominic, who was a tabloid headline writer.
He was.
Who came in and who said, oh no, everything I write is true.
Yeah, the worst
kind
sort
of headlines would he give us,
Chris? Didn't he oversee a story for a Los Angeles tabloid about a woman whose toaster was haunting her? Possessed by Satan.
The Weekly World News was like that in the National Enquirer. This was like the time before the internet, like in that way. So it was like you were looking at these things where it was like Elvis was taken by aliens and we need to know what they're doing with his body and like crazy stuff like that.
And they lifted, they started to lift that. And
it was
Richard Dominic.
Who stepped in and went for a walk with Jerry Springer and said to him, listen, your show, which was slipping down the ratings. I mean, the idea of Jerry Springer ever surpassing Oprah was just, that was a fancy.
Yeah, they were up at like 12, 13 million at the time. Yeah.
And Jerry Springer, because the ratings were down, it had been moved to a 1 a.m., 2 a.m. slot. Yeah. So his idea, Richard Dominic, was let's give viewers a 1 a.m. or a 2 a.m. show. Let's bring in people with the most obscene, the most absurd stories. Let's bring in someone who married his horse.
Oh yeah, no, please don't give them.
But it was this kind of stuff that Dominic thought it was just the lowest of the low. I mean, at various points in this documentary, he's asked, you know, what were the boundaries or what's the line? You know, what would you not feature on your show? And he was always saying there is no line.
Well, certainly Dominic had no.
Oh no, that's
there
it.
There was no moral compass at all.
I mean, it was Jerry Springer's name above the door, but Dominic was pulling the strings.
And also, there were other producers involved there as well. Toby Yoshimura, whose father had worked on Saturday Night Live. And they basically didn't speak to each other for four or five years.
He was ashamed of what he was doing and what he was doing. Like, I think this is like a documentary where the production team are there to atone for their sins almost. They're ready to talk about how they exploited and manipulated people. And, you know, they explain how they coached their guests in these arguments.
And you see those backstage coaches.
Yeah.
They're frightening.
Intense. They're ferocious. And they separated family members and friends to try and rile them up further, and even going so far as we were talking about there to decline pay for their travel home if they didn't go through with what the trajectory they had envisioned for that show. And the problem with this is these are tricks that the Jeremy Kyle show learned and used over a decade later, even though they were well aware of the consequences of what happened on the Jerry Springer show. They still went ahead and did this. And that makes for extremely uncomfortable viewing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it does put pressure. They put a lot of pressure on the production team to unearth these stories and how there was absolutely no duty of care directed towards these people. Like when I was watching the show growing up, I thought, they're actors. This is not real.
They were kind of.
But at the end of the day, these are real people.
Yeah, and you see, they talked about the Springer Triangle, which was not very different from the triangle we're talking about in terms of American primeval. But yes, that first episode of the Netflix series deals with the man who left his wife and daughter for a Shetland pony.
Yeah,
and you think this is a joke?
No, he did,
and he married the pony.
Dominic is at pains throughout this, and also Yoshimura to remind viewers that nothing that you saw on the Jerry Springer show was fake. But they do say that once the guests were brought in, they would rile them up, and they would, you know, get them to kind of lose their temper. But you had, let's face it, crazy stories like that. But then you also had a case where, you know, what seemed like a very simple love triangle involving a woman named Nancy Campbell Panitzu, whose ex-husband also appeared on the show with his new wife, where a couple of months after this argument between these three people aired on the Jerry Springer show, this man murdered his ex-wife, Nancy Campbell-Pertz. And you have in this documentary, the son, Jeffrey Campbell, interviewed about, you know, the connection between their appearance on the Jerry Springer show and the actual murder. And I understand that the documentary makers obviously wanted to find the craziest case that had been on the Jerry Springer show. But interviewing Jeffrey Campbell about something that has clearly had such an impact on his life, he is not the same person as a result of this. It just seems like re-traumatizing
him. It struck me that, because I only saw the first episode in the beginning of episode episode two, and he was the son is being interviewed there at the beginning of episode two, and you think this is the same exploitation that you're criticising.
That's it, exactly.
In the series itself, it's certainly delving into a space that you need to be very careful about. As the series progresses, do we get to know who Jerry Springer is at all? Because a lot of this is just, it is the production team. It is the production team who do all the choices of guests. That's no different than most radio programmes, most television programmes. The production team do all of that.
Mm.
But it's the Jerry Springer show. Do we get to know him anymore?
No, and it feels like he was at a remove. Now, Jerry Springer did die in 2023, but it feels like he was always at this kind of remove. Like, he was earning money. They said he was earning, whatever, 60 million from the show at one point. But you don't really get to know what he really felt about it, other than because he was the face of the show, he did have to answer a lot of questions about the what was happening with the show behind the scenes. And I do think, you know, Richard Dominic is there. I kind of enjoyed the fact that Richard Dominic, you're never going to change this man. Whereas the other production people were kind of like, oh God, I realise how bad you were. He was saying, look, it's either good television or it's not. And that's something that the Jerry Springer mindset, when he was defending the show, he started to mimic when it came under fire. But you never knew if he was the puppet there or what was happening.
Does this provide us with good television, this documentary series?
I think there is a great documentary to be made about the Jerry Springer show, because I think what it gave us was reality TV, the big, you know, your Big Brothers, the Real Housewives, even Drag Race, shows that are still there today and have a place, reality TV that we know and love. But it has this extremely checkered past and history, and I don't think it digs deep enough or offers anything other than this show was bad. And, you know, right now it feels like the ethos of the Jerry Springer show is everywhere. So was it always there? Like, this is the America that nobody wanted to acknowledge, but it's back in prime time. Mm. It's politics right now. So I wanted something a little bit more critical analysis, a little bit more depth. Right. But it is worthwhile to watch it to remind yourself of what how crazy time that was.
It was definitely. Absolutely. I mean, they give you little snippets of stories. You don't have to watch a whole episode. You'll get five or six snippets of stories. You just go, did they really do a story about that? Yes, they
when
did.
A TV show has a bouncer that becomes famous, Steve. Everybody knew Steve was the guy that got up on stage and pulled people away from each other. Yeah.
Stars,
that's something.
Stars from you on this one.
I'll give it a three.
Three. And what are you saying, Chris?
I thought it was about as deep as a puddle, and it should have been called Richard Dominic Fights Camera Action. There is a fascinating documentary about Jerry Springer to be made. This is not it. I would love to have known more about the man. Again, it's this thing. You go into it with questions about Jerry Springer, you come out of it with more questions about Jerry Springer. So something has clearly gone wrong. Two stars.
Two stars from you. That's Jerry Springer Fights Camera Action, available on Netflix. We also spoke about American Primeval, also which is available on Netflix as well, and Patience, which is currently on Channel 4. Thank you very much to Chris and to Jen. And so to this week's album releases, new works from three very distinctive artists, each at a different stage in their careers. Franz Ferdinand, Scottish band known for their Mercury Prize winning debut and a series of hit singles in the early 2000s. We're getting their sixth studio album. It's called The Human Fear. Ringo Starr, iconic former Beatles drummer with a solo career spanning over five decades, returns to country music with an album called Look Up, a collection of tracks produced in collaboration with none other than T-Bone Burnett. And Ethel Kane, critically acclaimed Southern Gothic artist whose 2022 debut, Preacher's Daughter, garnered widespread attention from many, including Barack Obama. She presents us with an album called Perverts, 90-minute experimental project to blending ambient textures with her signature storytelling. With me in studio, Zara Hederman and Owen Glacken. And let's start with Franz Ferdinand, opening track from their new album, The Human Fear. It's called Audacious.
You're standing way out where you're naked and freezing till you run.
At the beginning of 2025, we should not be saying don't stop. Oh no, he is. He's saying don't stop being audacious. That's fair enough.
He's encouraging you to be audacious.
You want to hear the word don't at the beginning of a positive statement. I find it very difficult to get my head around that. All right, Zara Hederman and Owen Glacken with me in studio this evening, if I didn't tell you that already. there is no wheel reinventing going on here with Franz Ferdinand Owen, I think it's safe to say.
No, I mean, look, they've been sort of staples on the I guess, the indie rock scene. They've been labelled as art rock, whatever that means, kind of all their career, because they sort of muck around with, you know, kind of interesting time signatures and song structures, I suppose. But yeah, they're not reinventing the wheel here. They're when I come to them, I don't come looking for edgy, you know, rock, you know, or genre defining rock or anything like that. I kind of come for fun, punchy, memorable guitar riffs, interesting song structures, and just a sort of a sense of fun. And that's, and from the get go, you get with Audacious, you get that it's not particularly edgy or anything like that, but it's good fun songwriting, and it, you know, they're not reinventing anything at all, really. No,
that's all. That's fair enough to be at the beginning of 2025. Even they might be audacious a little bit later on in the year.
Yeah, Zara. Absolutely. And there is a moment in Audacious where Alex Kapranos says, "Did you ever get a feeling that your world had come undone?" And I did, because 20 years ago, when Take Me Out came out, a song that has become such an anthem for them and has 1 billion streams on Spotify alone, I have always had such a love for Franz Ferdinand, and I was excited to listen to this. And as I listened and the 11 songs went on, I had the human fear. So the album title is quite accurate.
Yeah.
And for me as well, like, I just loved how inventive they were. As Owen said, like, they did interesting things back in the day. Alex Kapranos also has an incredible voice that's so like Scott Walker at times. And they used to be so theatrical. And this just felt like a lack of a straight vision or any direction in the studio. But also in the period since their last album, which was in 2018, and was like decent enough, they have lost 2 of their original members and they've been replaced.
Yeah.
Alex Kapranos has gotten married and has had a child, and he did say that that in particular has really inspired him. And there is a song on here, Hooked, which is one of the worst songs on the album.
We've got to address this.
That he says is about his newfound fatherhood.
His newfound fatherhood. This is what it sounds like, folks, if you're thinking of it in 2025. Look, what? Yeah, you are terribly cynical. He's happy. Is it a little boy that he has? Is it? Yeah, this is
I think so. And you can hear his child in that song warbling every now and again.
Yeah. And why wouldn't he? Why, and wouldn't you let him get on with it? I thought I knew love, but then I met you.
Yeah.
Just a lovely sentiment.
It's a lovely sentiment. But I swear to God, like, this is where the wheels fell off, certainly. This is track 4, and it sullies everything that came after it. It's certainly on my first listen. I had to go back and tell myself, no, be a little bit kinder to the later songs. But this, I swear to God, I'm not just saying it. I started to get this overwhelming thought in my head that I'm lying on my deathbed, hopefully centuries from now, a long time from now, and as in my last moments, and I hope we all think that, you know, we all want those last moments to be kind of comforting, and maybe our minds are drifting off to some, maybe our familiar mother's embrace, or we're frolicking through some field in Connemara.
You're very poetic. I know. January 1.
But in that moment, that song starts playing in my head. And I'm going, no, anything but that, and then lights out, and that's the last thing I ever experienced. That's a genuine fear I have in my life now.
That's called the human fear.
That's the human fear that I now have in my life because of that song. My wife came into the sitting room when I was listening to that album, which she never would, and just said, "What are you listening to?" And I said, "Franz Ferdinand." She goes, "That's awful." And I said, "I know. Like that's how bizarrely bad that song is."
Okay, but while I encourage you to think about long life, centuries from now, maybe a little bit optimistic.
Well, that's what I'm aiming for. So you do you, Sean. Yeah. Okay? Don't stop being audacious, Sean. Don't stop being.
Fair enough, taken on the chin, take that. Have you anything you like about it at all, Zara?
Do you know what? I tried to be optimistic, and there were 2 songs, Night or Day and Tell Me I Should Stay, that had moments within them that I was like, they have some kind of pizzazz to them. Night or Day reminds me a bit of Supergrass for their kind of jauntiness and their electric piano in there. But otherwise, like, those songs, they have good moments, but then Franz Ferdinand come in and just don't let you enjoy it for the whole 3 minutes.
Stars.
Unfortunately, it's a 1.5.
1.5. God, you're starting the year very pecunious. But I suppose you have to save them up. You don't want to be giving them all out in January, do you?
Exactly.
What are you saying, Owen?
because there are moments, as Ara said, Tell Me I Should Stay is actually quite a lovely song and goes into interesting places. It starts off in this kind of roomy, melancholic piano piece and goes off
the piano kind of
goes off into this sort of swirling.
Chopin might be pushing it, but it was certainly kind of classical.
And there's a song called Cats, which musically is quite interesting, but then there's the lyric about how you can't turn a cat into a dog that comes across like Alan Partridge.
That's true.
It is true. it's a truism. But anyway, so there are moments that are good. It's 2.5 for me.
2.5 from you. All right, let's move on to a beloved Beatle and solo artist. Ringo Starr's prolific career spans decades in pop and rock, and it includes his love of country music.
And I've got time on my hands. I turned my collar up, kept my eyes turned down. I walked the empty streets, the blue side of town. When she was my baby, I was a busy man. But she slipped through my fingers, and I've got time on my hands.
You should have been watching Ringo, instead of letting time slip through you, or letting her slip through your finger, as and finding time on your hands. It's very hard to not like Ringo Starr, Zara.
I know. He's so charismatic, and especially with everything that we've gotten recently with Get Back and Beatles 64, like, you just are reminded of like what a character he is. And actually the release of this album is quite fortuitous, because it's 55 years after the first country foray that Ringo Starr had with Boku of Blues, which is an excellent country album.
Yeah.
And he worked with legendary Pete Drake. Now,
there's T-Bone Burnett on this, like,
another legend. Yeah. And like, such a great musical sensibility. Yeah. And Ringo too. And like, as you heard there, the music is gorgeous on this.
The playing is amazing.
Yeah. No,
and the drumming, I didn't realise it, but it is Ringo Starr who's doing drumming.
Yeah, he does all of the drumming except on Come Back, which funnily enough was the seed for this album. Ringo and T-Bone Burnett fortuitously met in Chateau Marmont, as you do, in 2022. And Ringo asked him to send him a song, and he sent him Come Back, which also featured on T-Bone Burnett's album from last year, and it sounds a little more sparse. Okay, lyrically, as we heard there, now that she's gone, she slipped through my arms. There's another on the opening song where he has a line where, like, every time I think about you, I'm spellbound. When I see you on the boulevard, my heart beats hard. Like, he's never been known for his lyricism. Octopus's Garden is kind of indicative of that. But I did love his kind of warbling, soft and sweet vocals. Yeah. I was endeared.
Yeah, and so we mentioned T-Bone Burnett on the... T-Bone Burnett on the production end of things.
Yeah.
Great duets here as well. Well, great duos. I'm not sure about how duetty they are.
Yeah, there's some great guests and they're put to work really well. Again, you can't say enough good things about T-Bone's production. And there is co-production credits on it as well from Daniel Tashi and then Bruce Sugar. So there's a few hands at play here. But that those rich sort of just perfectly balanced mixes and stuff. It's so great, T-Bone stuff. But the guest stuff, Billy Strings is fantastic on it. He appears on quite a few songs, and it's quite unmistakable, his playing, you know, that busy fretwork that kind of gives it. And so some of the songs in the DNA of the songwriting, they're not maybe particularly country, like obviously country, but then someone like Billy Strings will come and country it up, if you know what I mean.
There was one song too that it was kind of going nowhere, and then Molly Burnett, what's her
Tuttle.
Name? Tuttle. sings a line, and I thought, oh, now I hear the song, you know, because oftentimes the lyrics in country songs, you know, they are a bit on the nose, but if you know how to deliver that, that's not a problem.
Yeah, and one thing that I did find, and it was that the real kind of failure of Look Up, was just how saccharine the lyrics were. Like, there's no in-depth storytelling here.
Yeah. Now, let's have a listen to a track that, according to the Skittles Leave Notes, features Alison Krauss.
Started to fall. I turned away from all the things that matter. From lost in the dust,
never know. Thankful for the stars above, hoping for more peace and love. Thankful when the sun is shining, day by day I'm really trying. Thankful for this moment here, and thankful you are here.
Now and then I hope there's the guitar bit coming. They play a little middle eight here, and we are going to hear the magnificence of Alison Krauss. Let's listen.
I needed a friend.
Right, all right. Now, I know she's there in the background. I know she's doing harmonies. But I mean, give her a verse. She really, I wanted to hear these people get proper outing. And he's charming and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And if you'd had on in the background and maybe you weren't listening to the lyrics too much.
Yeah, well, it is hard to get past some of the lyrics. And yeah. Again, it's the only, this is sort of unrelenting AABB structure to all the lines. And the lines are really short and snappy. Yeah. And it's like, you know, I will never leave you lonely. I will be your one and only from a song called Can You Hear Me Call. It's just really symptomatic of the sort of general lyrical insipidness that just becomes unrelentingly kind of borderline annoying. You know what I mean? Because you know exactly what the next word's going to be.
Stars.
For me, well, it's put together really well. The lyrics let it down. They really do. And seeing as Ringo outsourced a lot of the writing to T-Bone himself, maybe could have outsourced the lyric writing to somebody else with a bit more
stars.
Creativity. Three for me.
And what are you saying? Just stars to
It's all peace and love for me. It's 2.5.
2.5 from you. Let's move on very briefly and very quickly to Ethel Kane and Perverts. Emerging definitely as a singular voice, her Southern Gothic infused a debut, Preacher's Daughter, in 2022. Ethel Kane continues to evolve as an artist, unafraid to challenge conventions with this latest album, Perverts. It's full of experimental stuff. The introductions sometimes are, you know, and even the middles of the songs are just soundscapes for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Here's something closer to a song called Punish, but a beautiful voice. Unfair to her to do what I'm doing, which is, you know, not to let the track spin, because you really do have to give this album time if you're going to be in that world. It's a demanding world that she asks you to go into. Who is she, Sarah?
So she is a songwriter from Florida, and she came big with her album Preacher's Daughter, and she grew up in a very religious Southern Baptist family and kind of departed from that. And that first album really was an exploration of that kind of upbringing, but also she does this really fascinating thing of melding a lot of really harrowing and challenging elements into her songwriting here as well. We get that it abounds. But she became huge, and especially online, she has a massive, massive following. And I think this album is interesting because it's almost like turning her back on that. And there's a line in this album, "If you love me, keep it to yourself," which is almost like a direct thing to the fans.
Yeah, and the other thing, she starts with a version of Nearer My God to Thee, which is kind of slightly discordant, and that could last for maybe a minute and a half. And then there's a 10-minute just ambient track. There's very little happening on it.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing if it was late at night and I had my headphones on and I was in the right mood, I might have the time for it. I didn't have the time for it. Busy afternoon, Friday afternoon.
Yeah, I think it clocks in at 90 minutes, the whole album.
Yeah.
For 9 songs, you know, there's one track that's like 15 minutes and it is literally like 8 minutes of it. It's just a, you know what I mean, droning.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you have to be willing to go
the
way.
For your health.
Yeah. In that spookiness, I mean, there are moments that sounds like you're listening to an old-timey radio that's sort of accidentally tuned into some distant demonic realm, and you're hearing things that you wish you weren't hearing, but you're sort of it's quite captivating.
Right.
Still
stars from you on
well it, it's it's still 90 minutes and it's still a lot of drones, so it's 2.5.
I think you were a happier person at the end of this album.
Yeah, there. I loved the artistic ambition and bravery in this, and she wrote, recorded and engineered it herself, and I just think it's really such a captivating album, and it was a 4 from me.
A solid 4 from Zara Hedeman for Ethel Kane and Perverts. Zara Hedeman and Owen Glacken speak to us about Ethel Kane's album along with Ringo Starr's Look Up and Franz Ferdinand's The Human Fear, and that is our lot for this Friday evening. Leah Murphy researched, Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, Paddy Carney was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you on Monday, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1, and I do believe it's still Fiacna O'Brien on in the seat.